Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Hollywood has produced many films that touch on aspects of history, politics, and law. In their book, The United States Constitution in Film, Part of Our National Culture, Eric T. Casper and Quentin D. Veriger review many films that relate to the Constitution. From The Miranda Case and Dirty Harry to Network and Issues of Freedom of the Press, they examine how movies handle the legal issues that are part of the stories. Welcome, Eric and Quentin. Hi, Eric. Hi, Quentin.
Hello.
Hi.
First off, thanks for joining me. I don't remember now where I saw your book first. I get a lot of listings of books, obviously, film-related, and so I'm not sure exactly where I've seen where I saw it first, but as soon as I saw the title, The United States Constitution and Film, Part of Our National Culture, there was no question that I wanted to talk to you. So I'm glad we were able to find that time. So the first thing I like to do often is to give authors a chance to give me a little bit of their background, because it helps get a better sense of what led you to this particular project. So I guess we'll start with Eric. So you're in Wisconsin and you both teach for the same institution, although if I read right, it's not the same location. So you're welcome to go into there. So what is your background, especially as it might have related to get you to this project?
Sure. Well, I originally got my undergraduate degree at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. I then went to University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I got my master's degree in political science, PhD in political science, and then just because I'm a glutton for punishment, I got a law degree there as well. And I started teaching in the University of Wisconsin colleges in 2007, and it was a few years after that that Quentin began teaching in the colleges as well. And so I guess I'll let him talk a little bit about his background before we talk about how we started on this project together.
Sure. I'm from Lubbock, Texas originally, and I received my bachelor's and master's in English from Texas Tech. And there I studied literature and languages. And then I went to the University of South Florida where I received my PhD in English. I've been teaching film classes since 2010, and I've been writing in terms of pop culture since about that time as well. So my focus is on rhetoric and composition in terms of my degree, but I have a additional interest in pop culture and in film, and that in terms of an academic vantage point is where I sort of have come from in terms of this project. Eric and I, beginning in about 2013, started teaching a film class together. And the film class was not on the Constitution as a whole, but on the criminal justice system. And it was an interdisciplinary course. I taught the film analysis perspective, and Eric taught the legal and constitutional perspective of that. And so we were co-teachers among the same cohort of students, and we showed them ways of looking at films that were both in terms of film analysis and in terms of the law and how those things intersect. And it was really from that experience that the origins of this project started. And Eric, do you want to take it from there?
Yeah. And from us teaching that course together, we ended up writing a paper on the U.S. presidency as it's depicted in film. And we presented that at the Midwest Popular Culture Association conference a few years ago. And, you know, from there, between what we had taught in terms of the criminal justice system and particularly the rights of the criminally accused in our film class and what we had in terms of our paper about the U.S. presidency and the powers of the presidency depicted in film, we thought we could put together a volume here on the different aspects of the Constitution that come up in films, either stuff that's very much in the background or constitutional questions that can be very central to the focus of a film.
Well, that's good, because I think it sounds like you started at a good spot with the presidency, because that's obviously the most obvious thing, but then you built out, as we've talked already, there's 12 chapters to the book, and you devote a chapter to the first three chapters are obvious: Congress, presidency, and courts. And then you start to get into some of the different amendments, almost a good number of them, the Bill of Rights, although you do get into other amendments later on as we go through it. So how did you, since you're the film person, Quentin, how did you start to develop these lists? Or I'm assuming these are all films you've seen or at least heard about. So where did the lists start to come up, and how did you sort of work on the project to get so many films?
Well, Eric and I developed that list together, and we created a Google document, and there was a lot of preparatory work to try to figure out exactly how we were going to write this book in terms of scope. Were we going to try to talk about the entire Constitution? Were we only going to talk about certain parts? And then in terms of films, one of the things we noticed was that certain elements of the Constitution, there's just a glut, an overflowing of films. And the most difficult thing to do was to figure out which ones not to talk about. So the chapter having to do with the presidency, probably the chapter having to do with the Second Amendment, both of the chapters having to do with the First Amendment. There were just so many films that between Eric and I, we had to decide which are the most important films, which are the films that spur the most debate, that create the most discussion, and that are as historically relevant. And then with other chapters, like the chapter on the right to vote, and the Supreme Court chapter as well, we had sort of the opposite problem, right? There were a far more limited number of films, and we had to do some research and figure out which films could we talk about. Now, at the beginning of this project, both Eric and I had seen an enormous number of films that ultimately made it in our book. But through the writing of this project, both he and I really sort of improved and expanded on our film canon of knowledge, right? And part of what made this project so informative and frankly fun for the both of us is it gave us an opportunity to see films that either we hadn't seen before but we knew about, or to explore cinema we hadn't considered yet. But it was really difficult in terms of writing this book to think in terms of scope. What films go into the book? What are left out? And that was really the most difficult thing about cultivating that list. Eric, would you agree? Or?
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I would add is with regard to the actual design, the structure of the book, because for the last few years, I've actually served as the director of the Center for Constitutional Studies at UW-Eau Claire. And for the past several years there, my teaching load has been mostly classes about the U.S. Constitution. And so, some of this actually came out of me and the teaching that I've done in terms of those courses, in terms of the actual ordering of the chapters and how we ended up designing the chapters. It actually follows pretty well what I tend to have in my survey course of the U.S. Constitution. I start out with powers of government and then move on to rights and kind of moving more or less, through the Bill of Rights as they're numbered in order. Obviously, we don't have time to talk about all the amendments and all the rights or even all the powers, but trying to hit those big points in terms of the different parts of the federal government and separation of powers questions, followed by rights in the Bill of Rights and then rights that show up later in subsequent amendments. And so, I mean, it kind of has, a natural flow to it in terms of the way that a course that would be just on the Constitution is taught. But here you get the added bonus of learning about all these films. And within these individual chapters, then we ended up, for the most part, moving through chronologically in terms of films and when they were released. We shake things up a little bit, especially if there's historical films where a more modern historical film about someone long ago in the past. We might talk about that film a little bit earlier in the chapter. But otherwise, we tend to move chronologically in terms of film release dates within each chapter.
And then there were chapters that ultimately didn't make the final cut, mostly because of the fact that we were already writing so much about the chapters that ultimately made it into the book. For instance, we had originally planned to include a chapter on Prohibition, and that would have included such films as The Untouchables and Miller's Crossing. But there's just simply so much to talk about that we erred on the side of giving a fuller treatment to the parts of the Constitution that we could talk about.
One of the things I noticed is that it's not just lists. I mean, it may seem, you know, you mentioned specific films in general, but then for many of the films, you make sure to give an in-depth analysis, particularly of the constitutional aspects. Because one of the things I noted as I read through is that some of the movies you brought up, at first glance, you would say, what does that have to do with the Constitution? Especially if you just heard the title. But then the way you broke it down, some of the more obvious ones like Dirty Harry, where obviously there are constitutional aspects of it, so it was easy to fit that into its slot. But you also clearly showed how each one fit into your thesis. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention, because this was an important part of your introduction, is the idea of how people tend to learn about things just from what they see on movies and television. And that one of the reasons you were doing this was to show how much is out there that affects any of, you know, our knowledge of the Constitution. Was it your feeling or your experience, and let's start with Eric on this one, whether people just plainly misunderstand aspects of the Constitution and it's often because of the films they see?
Well, you know, a lot of films actually, I mean, and I would say probably most films do a pretty good job in terms of accurately portraying either what's in the constitutional text or what the Supreme Court has interpreted. And now there's always this aspect of how representative might an example be that's given in a film. For instance, if you've got a film, as you mentioned earlier, Dirty Harry, where within the film, I mean, it gives a particular portrayal about the rights of the accused, and it's a commentary on, at the time in the early 1970s, the reaction to the Warren Court's decisions broadly protecting the rights of the accused. And so, you know, because of that, the story goes down a certain path and wants to basically say, here's some of the downsides of protecting the rights of the accused that much. But in doing so, a lot of these films that do that sort of thing do have a pretty accurate portrayal of what the state of the law is. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that. Probably I don't know if I want to call it the worst example or the best example in this case, but Double Jeopardy, the film that was released in 1999, starring Ashley Judd, and it also had Tommy Lee Jones. And she ends up, or basically her husband frames her for murder, for his own murder, and then he disappears. She gets convicted and she's serving time in prison. And a disbarred attorney who is also serving time in prison has a conversation with Ashley Judd's character after Ashley Judd finds out that, well, actually, her husband may, in fact, be alive and that he framed her to be there. And this other character is basically trying to tell her that, look, if you get out of here, you can track him down and you can kill him. And, you know, they can't convict you for his murder again because that's what the Double Jeopardy Clause says. And in fact, that's not what it says, and it's not what it means, because it would be a separate incident, a separate occurrence, a separate violation of the law. And so it wouldn't be double jeopardy. You know, in that situation, somebody could get time served or it could be considered mitigating circumstances. But constitutionally, that second prosecution wouldn't be barred by the Constitution. And so, you know, sometimes we run into films like that. But, you know, for the most part, they are trying to give a pretty accurate portrayal. And I think most of these films do get decent advice as far as what the Constitution requires or how the Supreme Court has interpreted it.
I'll just sort of add to that. A lot of times what these films will do is they will spur debate. So they'll give people a sense of what the Constitution allows, for instance, in terms of the presidency. But then within that, there is debate among legal scholars, among the general public, as to how best to interpret the Constitution and to apply it. So one such film would be Lincoln, which came out in 2012. This is the one starring Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln. And in the film, there is definitely an emphasis on the president as someone who has enormous executive power. There is a sort of valoration and glorification of Lincoln, not just as someone with virtue or high standards, but someone who knows the power he has within the presidency and exercises that. There's a scene where he's talking to his cabinet and he pounds on the table and he says, "I am the president, clothed in enormous power." And then he says, "Procure me these votes." And the whole scene sort of evokes a sense of not just that this is what Lincoln wants, but he knows the power he has as president to make that happen. At the time that film came out, there was an ongoing conversation, for instance, about what role executive authority had in terms of, At the time that film came out, there was a lot of debate in the news about executive power and about presidential power. And that film helped to spur that debate on and create a conversation about the appropriate use of presidential power in the 21st century. And I don't know, Eric, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, the other thing I would throw out there is that the film itself, as we're looking at the latter stages of the Civil War, and of course talking about a completely separate issues constitutionally in terms of slavery and the 13th Amendment and the amendment process even, going back to that period, kind of from the middle to the later stages of the Civil War, this notion of a very empowered presidency and even the Supreme Court in the prize cases, interpreting presidential power, presidential war power quite broadly And really the first instance of the Supreme Court interpreting the president's war power occurs during the Civil War. And they give a broad reading to it, basically saying that Lincoln had the power to blockade Southern ports and to mobilize the Union Army and to take certain actions before Congress declared war, because Congress wasn't in session when the secession of the Southern states was taking place. And so the Supreme Court is basically deferring to the president, saying, look, just because Congress didn't say a war officially began doesn't mean that war can't occur, and the president has to be able to take action accordingly. So it's actually an interesting historical moment with that film as well, because it's really the first Supreme Court case that gives this broader and more expansive view to presidential powers under Article II of the Constitution.
And I know that over time, that whole issue of presidential power has been particularly important in general, but then also in film, and as we get into even more recent times in the 70s, particularly right around, you know, Watergate and Vietnam, where Congress, at least in some ways, decides to reach back out and try to gain a little bit more control on their own. And so we have the War Powers Act and then some of the other investigations to try to give to balance it out a little bit more, because there's no question that most people these days are used to the concept of a strong president. And so it's not a surprise that the most films that have a president in them, he's always presented in that way.
And sometimes for good and sometimes for bad, right?
Right.
The president, and I think Quentin, you'd agree with that. I mean, the president is typically going to be portrayed, and there's some exceptions to this with noteworthy reasons why, but typically the president's going to be portrayed as powerful, in part because I think rhetorically that's a useful device, but also because, I mean, it does reflect reality in the modern era, especially in the nuclear age, even with some attempts by Congress notwithstanding to rein in that power, the modern president does exercise a lot of authority. And so whether it's being used in a film to demonstrate that we need a powerful president to, you know, root out terrorism or to deal with foreign adversaries or these sorts of things, or on the other hand, talking about the dangers of a powerful president, how the American people could be targeted by the president, or films that get into conspiracy theory types of issues where the president is involved in some nefarious plot to do something. All those films, again, whether they're saying having a powerful president is good or bad, they're still reflecting the reality that the presidency has a sizable amount of authority to it.
Yes, I would agree with all of that. You know, when you're making a film about the presidency and the president is most likely going to be the main character, usually the protagonist, you're going to need to put a lot of agency or control in his hands, just for narrative reasons. So it just so happens from that point of view that the president is going to be the main actor in the film and is going to be seen as the person moving the plot along, encountering adversaries and overcoming those adversaries. Moreover, culturally, we see the presidency as a place where someone can bring redemption to the nation. I think that as a culture, we tend to see the president as a type of salvation figure, sort of Moses leading us out of the wilderness. And that connects to films as well. The president is the hero of the film. The president is the one who's going to deliver us from what evil the film starts with, whatever problems are encountered at the beginning of the film. And so with the exception of when they're trying to show some sort of danger in the presidency, and even then, there's often emphasis on either the good or the bad side of the power of the presidency.
And I would just add to that, I mean, obviously, as we're doing this right now, there's this question over the emergency powers of President Trump and whether or not Congress is going to try to limit the president in his decision to take funds that Congress had allocated to the military and move them to be used to build a border wall. And that debate is really tied up in this, I mean, this ongoing struggle between, on the one hand, Congress's Article I powers as the legislature, and then the president's Article II powers as the executive. And I mean, those debates go back to the Constitutional Convention, what the proper role of those two institutions are. They come up in, historically, during the period of Thomas Jefferson and making the Louisiana Purchase, to obviously during the Civil War, questions of war powers during World War II and during the Cold War, and right up through, during the War on Terrorism and into more contemporary questions that we're looking at. So, the fact that this culturally has been, legally and politically has been an unresolved question, where the line is between what the president can do and what is really congressional power. It's no surprise that that's a frequent issue that comes up in films that talk about the presidency as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I note that some of the more current, now this is on the print side, although many films obviously are based on books, and I'm thinking of Absolute Power is the most obvious one, where the president in books, more current books, it's often a conspiracy of some sort, as you mentioned, or the president is quote unquote evil, but gets out. And how do you deal with that? So that's on a more, it's less what is considered normal for a president and more abnormal. And so I just feel like these days that whole issue of possible conspiracies has taken over many aspects of at least fictional films that and books, more importantly, that feature the president. Is this something, or in a number of examples you even mentioned in your book related to that, including Clear and Present Danger, is one that I can think of that the president appears in there, but there is a whole issue related to conspiracies and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely, as you'd mentioned earlier, a lot of that stems from Watergate and post-Watergate, and reflecting reality in terms of the involvement of an actual president in something along those lines. It helps to spur on these types of stories. I think it's also a reflection of where we are in terms of media, in terms of the polarization of media, that it's, when we're talking about news media in particular, as well as social media, where we've gotten this polarization not only there, but in American politics generally. And so there's a lot of sense of, if one is in the media and they're not the media that's friendly to the current occupant of the White House, whoever that is, that there is a greater likelihood that there are going to be news stories or opinion pieces that are raising questions about all sorts of things, from everything going on with President Trump right now related to Russian interference in the 2016 election, to questions that were raised by other media sources about President Obama's birth certificate and where he was actually born, to going back to questions about Whitewater and President Clinton. And so we have a lot of these types of stories that are in the media, And so, you know, I think that becomes a natural springboard for those same sorts of questions to be raised in films. But again, this notion of a more partisan press attacking whoever is in the White House at the moment, or attacking whoever is running for president of the other party, that's nothing new. I mean, that goes back to a very, very early in the Republic. And although we had kind of, you know, there's a lot of kind of a post-World War II, especially during the Cold War, sentiment of, you know, the media didn't act that way, and for the most part didn't behave in that way. That's really not the historical norm throughout much of American history. And so in that sense, we're returning to the norm that we used to have, which helps to fuel this. That's not necessarily a good thing, but it also does, and it shouldn't be surprising given that historically this was much more so the case if you go back 150, 200 years.
Right. They got newspapers that were specifically, a city might have multiple newspapers, and one is going to be on one side most likely, which is where their names often come from. If you listen to the name of think of various newspapers that many know might not exist anymore, they often had a slant towards one party or the other, and that was just part of the way they did business.
Well, you had mentioned a lot of films about the presidency don't really feature the president as the central character, or somewhat are connected to a type of conspiracy. I think a lot of films like that sort of deal with not so much the presidency, but the executive branch and what in the last couple of years people have referred to as the deep state. So films like the Mission Impossible series, the Bourne Supremacy series, Enemy of the State, which was a 90s film starring Gene Hackman and Will Smith, or recently in the last 10 years, there's been films on Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. All of those films are in a sense about the presidency, but they're not about the presidency themselves. They're about the larger bureaucratic state that is largely housed within the executive branch. And many of those films address the issue of whether or not that executive branch has become too unwieldy, too powerful. But instead of embodying that power within one person, like the film Lincoln does, or the film Absolute Power does, they address it more within the sense of what has this branch become, and how has the power of the executive become a systemic problem. And so, for example, in many ways, Enemy of the State in the 90s sort of presages the conversations we have had for the last 7 years or so, or 8 years or so, about the surveillance state with Edward Snowden. And I don't know if I would call, well, many of those are sort of conspiracy films, but they definitely are less about the president than about the federal bureaucracy, much of which is housed within the executive branch.
Right, including most intelligence functions.
Well, I'm sorry. I was just going to add this, the tension that's there between the press and the presidency. I mean, that comes up in several noteworthy films as well. And even given the fact that there's a partisanship that occurs in the press, I mean, that shouldn't negate the fact also that there can still be good investigative journalism. There can still be good work done by the press, and there is good work done by the press to uncover these sorts of things. And the films that do that well, like All the President's Men in the 1970s, or more recently, just a couple of years ago with The Post, you know, whether it's either with All the President's Men looking at Watergate, or The Post looking at the Pentagon Papers, you have films that talk about that natural tension that's there, and also that discuss or put on display for us the importance of the First Amendment and the freedom of the press protecting the right of the media to go out there and to do its job in terms of investigating what the executive branch is doing. Although there are some films historically, especially, that question the role of the press in doing some of these things, for the most part, I mean, there's a very positive portrayal of the press, and I think rightfully so, in terms of doing its job to expose these sorts of secrets or these sorts of issues to the public so that the public can be better informed. And there's also, I think as we talk about in the book, there's also a natural connection here between filmmakers in Hollywood and those who are in the press. And I think that's also one of the reasons why, you know, film, I mean, they're all doing either some sort of expressive work or some sort of work that is getting ideas out to the public, information out to the public. And so that kind of goes hand in hand that you would expect for the most part. Hollywood is going to have a positive portrayal of the media because they're both protected by, and then they both tend to envelop themselves in the First Amendment and what that represents.
So let's back up to the pre. I mean, obviously, as I've mentioned, your first three chapters are devoted to the three branches, and we've been mostly talking about the presidency. I want to talk a little bit about the Congress because it actually is also featured in Lincoln. And so Congress, one of the things I didn't know there were as many films that featured Congress. That was the thing that once you I started reading the titles, is oh, yeah. So I was a little bit surprised, but in a good way. Is Congress being as well, generally speaking, portrayed as we've been talking about with some of the other aspects of the Constitution?
Well, I think, you know, with Congress, you know, part of the issue is you've got an institution of 535 voting members, and so it's hard to really center on individual members of Congress or center on the institution as a whole the way you can with the presidency. But there is, and there has been for quite some time, there's been a tension in terms of the public's view of Congress versus the view of their own representative in Congress. And I think that plays into why Congress gets portrayed in a bit more of a mixed way in films than the presidency does, which tends to be more positive. Because obviously if we have high reelection rates, which we do, and it's been the case for quite some time, then individual members of Congress are popular with their own districts or in their own states. And the issue becomes then the popularity of the institution as a whole, which individual members will run against when it's election time, and which, you know, the presidents, especially if Congress is not controlled by the president's party, they will talk against. And, you know, this leads, and the fact that Congress oftentimes doesn't do a whole lot, right? And it's difficult to get legislation passed, and so there typically isn't a lot that gets passed. And so the institution tends to have relatively low public approval. But some of that is unfair. I mean, the reason Congress works the way it does is because constitutionally it's set up that way. It's set up to be inefficient. It's set up to not get a lot of stuff done, right? That's why it's broken into two chambers and why you need to get the president's signature. Otherwise, you have to get supermajorities to override legislation. But I think that public sentiment about, you know, the popularity of Congress helps to feed into these narratives in film, where they get this much more mixed portrayal. Even in a film like, for instance, Charlie Wilson's War, where here you have Congress under with the leadership of Charlie Wilson doing some really good things to bring an end to what's going on in Afghanistan at the time and to help those who are fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, ultimately playing a major role in, or at least a significant role in, ending the Cold War. But even that film says, look, I mean, Congress still couldn't get its act together afterwards, and it's because we didn't pass bills that could help do funding for to help rehabilitate the region and to rebuild it after the war, that helps give rise to the Taliban and helps give rise to Al Qaeda. And so it's an instance of, well, even when Congress is doing some things right, they still screw things up in the end, right? And I think that's a popular narrative that we tend to see in these types of films.
I think that with, just to bounce off of that, there is a tradition in these films of showing a candidate or a elected official with a good heart, or perhaps at least good intentions, but who ultimately runs up against so many obstacles that they fail. So Charlie Wilson's War is one. Another one is The Candidate, starring Robert Redford. Now, that's more about running for office, but the implications towards the end of that film are after Redford's character gets elected, I believe it's his character that says, "What now?" or "What next?" Right? There's this sense of it's one thing to have good intentions, it's one thing to try, but the inertia and the bureaucratic mechanisms of the House or the Senate will prevent change oftentimes from happening. So there's that tension between the intentions of the individual and the pressures pushing back from the institution.
And of course, the other aspect of Congress that does get featured in films is the hearings part, the investigations that Congress does. And the most obvious one I can think of is the crime committee in Godfather Part Two, where it's pretty obvious this is a congressional committee. And so we do see Congress in that role, where they are often more likely to be presented in a more favorable tone because they're actually doing something.
Right. And especially in that film, they're out to get the bad guys. Right. Although, you know, obviously the character that Al Pacino is playing in that film, I mean, it's also the star of the film. And so it has its own complications to it. But yeah, that's an instance where Congress is exercising actually not some sort of enumerated or explicit power that it has under the Constitution, but its investigatory function, those types of hearings, was generally considered one of Congress's implied powers, because it needs to be able to hold hearings to gather evidence and information in order to pass laws. There aren't a ton of films that focus on that aspect of Congress, but that film, The Godfather Part II, does it really well in terms of not only showing the sorts of things that can happen in those hearings and giving you some examples of that, but also demonstrating the witnesses who come into these hearings are required to testify under oath, and that they can be held in contempt, or they can be prosecuted for perjury if they fail to answer questions, or they fail to answer questions truthfully. And then also the politics behind it, right? The grandstanding aspect that can go on, which is very common in these hearings, right? Where, again, there's a specific constitutional function these hearings fulfill, but then politically, besides actually gathering evidence, it's an opportunity for a member of Congress on TV in front of a live audience across the country to be able to make a political point, or to show how angry and upset they are about something, and to show their how they're not going to stand for this sort of thing anymore. And so there's a political theater that goes along with that as well.
And that actually comes out in Godfather Part Two, because the character who ends up the Nevada senator who we see at the beginning, and then at the end is in this hearings, he has to leave, but he has to get up and make this nice statement about Italians are great people, and you know, we shouldn't use this as a way to be against Italians. So you see the grandstanding right there.
And the fact that, you know, that, and again, not a lot of films would have that portrayal as a central part of the plot. But I think it's also noteworthy that film, released in 1974, I mean, this is right when the country is in the midst of all the Watergate hearings. And so, I mean, it was something that an audience would be prepared for and would say, oh, that's an appropriate thing. I would expect that to be something that Congress would do. And it was at a time when Congress, in fact, at least in that aspect of its constitutional role, was being very active in terms of holding hearings on major questions that were important to the public.
Although it's fair to point out that that Nevada senator is also portrayed as corrupt and in a very sort of negative light throughout the film. So the film is portraying the power of the legislative branch to investigate, but at the same time, putting a dark light or dark spin on the intentions of the senator who's featured. And that in many ways is also representative of the post-Watergate era in terms of how films represent the government. After Watergate, there was definitely a darker turn towards the representation of the federal government in film.
So, as we've said, the later chapters in the book are either devoted to a single amendment or a combination of amendments. And of course, there's so many, the chapter on freedom of religion and from religion, and then of course, freedom of speech and press, and so on. The one I wanted to really talk about is the one that you talk about. It comes from your introduction, actually, and that's when we've already touched on it, and that's what came through as part of the Miranda decision, which of course also has a court thing to it. So can you briefly, obviously the Miranda decision was important, but how did it start to appear in films?
Yeah, well, it's there's a bit of a, as we talked about earlier, a bit of a backlash that comes up with that decision in particular in Dirty Harry in 1971. And it's at a time when the Warren Court decisions and the Miranda decision being kind of the high watermark of those decisions on the rights of the accused, when that was under some pretty significant public scrutiny. And a lot of that stems from not just, you know, groups like the John Birch Society and others who were they went on campaigns as far as trying to convince Congress to impeach Earl Warren, for instance. But by the time you get to the 1968 presidential election, you have Richard Nixon, when he's running for the White House, running his law and order campaign and saying, look, you know, we need to appoint justices to the U.S. Supreme Court who are not going to just turn criminals loose on society, right? And although the idea of a president running against the Supreme Court is nothing new, and it happens just about every 4 years where, you know, the president is part of what presidents campaign on is, look, if I'm elected, I'm going to appoint people to the Supreme Court who are like me and the way I think. So it'll change the course of how the Constitution and how the law is interpreted. So that's nothing new. And it actually goes back much farther than President Nixon. But the fact that within a few years he made four appointments to the court, it also was a point in U.S. history where the Supreme Court started to shift on some of these questions, particularly on the rights of the criminally accused. And so this film becomes a way not only of expressing a particular view about the way the rights of the accused should be interpreted, but also the film, it kind of gives us a bit of a premonition or a bit of an understanding of the direction the court's going to go in. Because as we talk about in the book, after 1971, you have over the course of about the next 10 to 15 years, you have several decisions which would have allowed the admission of evidence that it would have needed to have been excluded in Dirty Harry from being able to be admitted in court. And so I think you have that film there not only as a commentary, a particular viewpoint on the Constitution and what the Supreme Court has interpreted, but also it kind of leads the way to a more, in terms of the politics of the court, a direction that they go in where they start to find exceptions to some of these major Warren Court rulings.
Within Dirty Harry, one of the interesting things that you see is a lot of low-key lighting, a lot of dark lighting, which creates an ominous mood. There are many ways in which the film evokes a sense of frustration and negativity towards the ability of law enforcement to carry out their job. And throughout the film, we see ways in which Callahan, the character played...
Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood, yeah. Throughout the film, we see a variety of ways in which Callahan, the character played by Clint Eastwood, is frustrated in his attempts to either catch Scorpio, the serial killer, or in some other way execute his job. And so this is a sort of a larger motif, a larger theme throughout the film. And the Miranda element of the film is part of that larger theme throughout the film. And by the end of the film, Callahan is so frustrated, he just simply seems to quit, right? He has in some ways given up. And this thematic frustration is something that the Miranda scene in that film reinforces, and part of the overall cultural frustration that Eric was just speaking to.
Yeah, and I would add, you know, the Miranda decision was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court. The Miranda decision, when it was released, was a polarizing one amongst the public. And if throughout that chapter, we talk about the rights of the accused as they apply to interaction with police, you know, search and seizures or confessions and interrogations and these sorts of things. You see that tension in the films, right? Where there's some films, the point of the film is we have to, you know, vigorously protect the rights of the accused against the threat of what the police might do and the threat of us, you know, living in a totalitarian state if the police have too much power. Now, on the other hand, there's a sizable number of films that get to this issue of, well, look, you know, the rights of the accused are protected too much. What about the rights of crime victims? What about the fact that, you know, not too many criminals can go free because of what seems like a minor mistake by someone in law enforcement? And that tension that is there in those films, and, you know, some filmmakers who go in one direction, some go in the other direction. We see that in a few other places in terms of the films about the Constitution. I mean, the Second Amendment, right to keep and bear arms, is one as an example. But and the presidency, as we talked about, is another example, you know, as a powerful president, good or bad. But, you know, a lot of these areas of film tend to be much more, you know, tend to be in the sense of there's most of the films are portraying one message, right? Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, voting rights, equal protection of the law. Those are areas where we tend to have films that are almost totally on the side of saying, yes, these are good rights. These rights need to be protected. But the rights of the accused and even the rights of the accused in a court, right? You know, right to a jury trial, right to an attorney, right? These tend to be very popular in film as well. But the rights of the accused with respect to law enforcement, there is a division there in terms of the two different camps of filmmakers.
And then from that, you actually brought it up between the police and then the courts and then the convicted. You talk about that you've got a number of good examples there. I wanted to also bring up. The chapter on freedom and the right to privacy. That chapter to me was interesting because there are all kinds of issues these days, especially as it relates to privacy. And was this a chapter you definitely felt you had to include because of issues of privacy in 21st century time?
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely the case. You know, the use of technology, you know, modern technology, really raises a lot of privacy questions. Now, again, that's also nothing new, right? You know, if you go back to the 1960s, Katz versus the United States, there's a question of putting a phone tap on a phone booth, which I think our students today, most of them have never seen a phone booth. They don't even know what that is. But, you know, those questions have been with us for a long time. But Supreme Court in recent years has gotten into those issues, questions about, if a GPS tracking device is used on a car without a warrant, the Supreme Court finding that to be problematic constitutionally. The attempts by law enforcement to unlock a cell phone and to access what's on there, there's clear Fourth Amendment implications there, the Supreme Court has found. And so those sorts of issues are renewed anytime we have new technology, and given just the vastness of technology and how much it's integrated into our lives now, I think that there was no question for us. We had to say something about films on it, because there are a number of films that get to those points, whether it's, films that are a little bit older in terms of, The Enemy of the State, or going back to the 1990s, or a film like Her, or some of these films about, as we talked about earlier, whether it's getting into questions of, Edward Snowden, and questions of what he did, or questions about WikiLeaks, right? All these questions about privacy, what truly is private, what's left anymore. It's clearly on the public's mind, and it's on the minds of filmmakers as well.
In terms of reproductive rights, that was an element of that chapter too. And one of the interesting observations about the way in which films treat privacy rights is when it comes to things like the government and surveillance in terms of Snowden or Enemy of the State, there's a far less ambiguous treatment of those types of issues in film than when it comes to issues like reproductive rights. That I'm sure is in large part due to the fact that the country is so intensely divided on those issues. So if you look at the movie Juno, Juno deals very sort of delicately with abortion. It does it in such a way that it doesn't really tip its hand one way or the other in terms of giving a clear preference towards either the pro-choice or the pro-life movement. Ultimately, in that film, Juno has to decide whether to carry the child to term. She decides to carry the child to term, but there, through the film, is a treatment of abortion in such a way that it isn't stigmatized. So for viewers who are very intensely pro-life, they're going to come away from that film affirmed, whereas viewers who are more pro-choice can also see something in that film that reinforces their perspective. And in that chapter, we saw that sort of treatment in terms of reproductive rights, a type of ambiguity, a type of delicacy when approaching the issue, a type of even-handedness in some ways.
Obviously, these topics are going to always be around, and I think it's pretty obvious that we're going to continue to see films that feature aspects of the Constitution. So I have to ask you, even though it's not in your book because it's too new, what your thoughts are of Vice? I don't know whether you liked it or hated it, but there's quite a bit of constitutional aspects to that film.
As a viewer, I really loved the film Vice. So I'll just start as a viewer. I thought it was enormously clever and enormously funny. The film is basically a type of satirical treatment of Dick Cheney throughout his life, while at the same time trying to get a sense of the motivation as to why he made the choices he did. And I thought the film did a really clever job of intermixing sort of serious moments with humor. In terms of the Constitution, one of the things that we see in Vice is what we talked about in terms of the presidential films, just a reinforcement of the power that is vested in the presidency. Cheney, through his role as vice president, was able to enact an enormous amount of power onto the executive branch and onto the country. And this film, in that sense, just simply reinforces the other films that comment on the enormous power of the presidency. What makes this film at least somewhat different from those films is it shows the elasticity that the office of the vice presidency has. The office of the vice presidency actually technically only has a very limited number of powers, including tie-breaking votes in the Senate. But Cheney was able to use that office in a much more powerful and expansive way. The film also comments on his time as a chief of staff and as a member of Congress. And so the other thing I think that we can get out of this film is the way in which if you know how to use the levers of power, a person with an enormous amount of insight into that can have a disproportionate amount of control over the government.
And I'll have to confess, I haven't seen the film yet, so I'll refrain from commenting on the film. But just to reiterate, I mean, the Dick Cheney's vice presidency was, I mean, it was during a period when the amount of power vested in the presidency because of actions by the president or decisions by the president was on the increase. Certainly that was the case even in the run up to what happened during the Bush presidency with 9/11 and how that even helped to accommodate a greater role for Vice President Dick Cheney. You know, if you go back to the 1990s, the tasks that Bill Clinton gave to Al Gore were certainly greater than we had seen in the past for the vice presidency. And you see a buildup as well. If you go back to the 1980s between Reagan and George H.W. Bush in terms of building up the power of the vice presidency. And so it's certainly along those trends and it took it to a new higher degree in terms of vice presidential power than we had seen before.
And then when Obama and Biden were elected, I remember one of the things Biden said was he was going to try to create a more rebalanced version of the vice presidency, right? So it changes from term to term and from presidency to presidency.
What's interesting about the film is one of the points they make is that supposedly Cheney believes in there's a legal concept that seems to indicate that the presidency is the most important branch of the government instead of them being three co-equal branches. And it's talked about early on in the film that this is a belief, and that goes back to the idea that of the differences in the separation of powers. So,
yeah, and of course, if you go back to the Constitutional Convention, what the delegates there and James Madison in particular, but others thought is that it would be Congress that would always predominate. And Congress would be the strongest branch because it was the people's representatives from all across the country. And because they had the lawmaking function, I mean, that was what they believed would be the case. And that's why, again, they break it up into two houses, why they give the president a role in the legislative process, because they didn't want the legislative branch to be so overpowering over the other two. And of course, because of delegation of power by Congress to the executive branch over time, and because of the perceived need in the modern world for someone to act quickly, again, in the nuclear age, and in all honesty, because of the changes in media and how, you know, the president becomes someone who's followed around by the press and is very familiar to just about every American, the role of that office has definitely grown. And in certain aspects, it's grown at the expense of Congress.
We've only scratched the surface, obviously. You discuss so many different films, and I really think it did a great job of presenting not only what the aspects were related to the Constitution of the various films, but more importantly, discussed how well they represented, or in some cases, not so well. So I really want to say that this was I really enjoyed this book, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it because I think people will find the book quite interesting, and there's a number of films now I have to go make sure I go to see, some of them just so I get a better sense of how, you know, your points of view and then how I see them. Are you working on other things together, or are you just finished this book, so you're just sort of resting for a second?
Well, right now we're resting. We've tossed around some ideas about what the next stage of this research could be, but that would be maybe like in a year or two. And right now we're just either pursuing other projects or talking about this one.
Yeah. There's a possibility someday, you know, we might do something on the Constitution and television, but that's really just at the thought stage at this point. So,
well, like I say, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I think, as I said before, the book is very thought-provoking, and just as importantly, it's an interesting way to look at film, something that the average person might not even think about. So thanks for joining me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks to Eric and Quentin for their time and conversation. Besides being an interesting book, I think it also has relevance to political science and film classes. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.